The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. We begin with today's cover story, Getting Cute. New science reveals its power goes way beyond babies. Chubby-cheeked babies, wide-eyed puppies, and wobbly kittens. We know cute when we see it. We'll stir learning, however, what it does to our brains and behavior. Once thought to trigger a hardwired, primarily maternal caregiving response, researchers are now learning that cuteness actually sets off unique brain activity in women and men that goes beyond making sure Junior wants for nothing. Marketers and product designers have known for decades that cuteness sells, but a series of recent studies suggests that it's less about caregiving and more about empathy, community, and sharing. In fact, understanding what cuteness is and how it affects us may help harness its powers for good. Perhaps unexpectedly, the science of cuteness starts with Nazis. In the 1930s, Austrian ethologist Konrad Lorenz rose to prominence studying animal behavior to explain why humans do what we do. Lorenz would eventually share a Nobel Prize for his work. And his influence in the field was immense. Virtually every academic study published on cuteness references his idea of Kinchen schema, or baby schema. Infants and many mammal species have a suite of features such as a large head, large eyes, and a small nose that prompt a caregiving response. Lorenz suggested that Kinchen schema triggered biologically built-in rather than learned behavior. This type of rabid, hardwired response to a stimulus, known as an innate releasing mechanism, means humans would seek to nurture and protect an infant even if they had never before seen a baby. And it's not just young from your own kind that elicit this response. Other species with Kinchen schema traits can compel us to provide care too. Despite Lorenz's prominence and the popularity of his Kinchen schema work, something the myriad studies that name-drop him don't mention is that he wasn't a fan of our generalized cross-species cuteness response. It was at odds with his ideology, which aligned with Germany's Third Reich. Lorenz, a card-carrying Nazi eugenicist and advocate of the National Socialist doctrine of racial hygiene, actually believed that the fact that we feel baby animals are cute is a bad thing, says cultural theorist Joshua Paul Dale, a professor of English at Tokyo Kagukei University and editor of The Aesthetics and Effects of Cuteness. Lorenz considered this to be the misfiring of a pure primal instinct to care only for one's own young. After World War II, other researchers began to test Lorenz's hypothesis about Kinchen schema activating instinctual caregiving. They both succeeded and failed, Dale says. He adds that while Kinchen schema turned out to be an accurate way of defining cute stimuli, an individual's response to it, shaped by personal experience, cultural variation, and other factors, was not as automatic as the Austrian researcher had hypothesized. Says Dale, it does not operate mechanically like flushing a toilet, as Lawrence said. For scientists focused on the psychology of cuteness, the realization that our response to it is more complex than originally thought was the first hint that Kinchen schema evokes more than just caregiving. Meanwhile, researchers trying to understand how cuteness evolved in the first place began to look more closely at which species exhibit it. Daniel Kruger, an evolutionary psychologist at the University of Michigan, believes cuteness can be explained through something called life history theory. It's a framework for understanding how natural selection may have shaped a species' anatomy and behavior at different stages of life. At birth, many species must fend for themselves, such as the brush turkeys of Australia and Indonesia. Juveniles hatch fully feathered and virtually ready to fly. Other species, particularly mammals, are born fairly helpless and rely on parental care for an extended period. Every organism has limited resources. So how are we going to allocate that effort? It's always a trade-off, says Kruger. We see a convergence of high intelligence and slower development. There's a need for parental care because the brain is developing over a longer period of time. Or, as his University of Michigan colleague Stephanie Preston puts it, if there's pressure to evolve a bigger brain, the brain can only get so big and still make it through the birth canal. So you come out with the brain not fully finished, still needing to develop, and you need more parental care. Preston, a professor of psychology and director of the Ecological Neuroscience Lab, studies how and why behaviors evolved in both humans and other species. She notes that some form of kinchin schema turns up across the board in social mammals whose young require parental care. Not every species has the same response, however. For example, Preston says, sheep live in social groups, and all pregnant ewes in the group typically give birth at about the same time of the year. Their lambs exhibit kinchin schema, but ewes are very sensitive to kin recognition and will only nurture their own offspring. It's likely the response evolved to make sure that mom wasn't wasting her milk on someone else's baby. On the other hand, rats are also social and live in groups, but they do not have pups at the same time, similar to our own species. The rodents have a more generalized response to cuteness and will actively nurture and protect young that are not their own. As a result, the entire group benefits because individuals help members in need, regardless of kinship. When Lawrence poo-pooed humans' non-specific cuteness response, he missed this benefit. In evolutionary terms, if it were a bad thing, a mechanism would have evolved to make the response more specific to our kin, Preston says. In fact, Dale and some other researchers see our generalized cuteness response as crucial to becoming the species we are today. Dale notes that human babies don't attain peak cuteness until they're 5 or 6 months old. This is the age when infants begin to be more aware of other people and the relationship to them, and thus are able to respond to socialization, he says. I don't have children, but when I see a cute child, I smile and I hope to receive a smile in return. I think that cuteness encourages us to help socialize children who are not our own, and that this was a revolutionary behavior that helped us to develop the cooperative skills and collaborative abilities that make us human. Lawrence and other 20th century researchers had limited tools to study the neurological activity that cuteness triggers. More recently, though, broader access to different types of brain scans has given scientists a much better view. In a study published in 2009 in the journal PNAS, for example, researchers used functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, to monitor brain activity when adults viewed images of infant faces. Some of the images had been digitally manipulated to enhance or reduce their kinchin schema. Study participants rated the infant faces with enhanced kinchin schema as cuter. Those images also set off more activity in parts of the brain involved in reward processing, such as the precuneus, associated with attention, and the nucleus accumbens, which is linked to the anticipation of a reward. The findings were among the first to show that kinchin schema trips our reward motivation wires, leading us to want to pay attention to and care for an infant, even if not our own. Another thing we know, our cuteness response is lightning fast. At about the same time as the PNAS study, University of Oxford neuroscientist Morten Kringelbach was studying cuteness using a different type of brain scan, magnetoencephalography, MEG. It looks like a large hairdryer, quips Kringelbach, adding that the benefit of MEG is that it shows not only which areas of the brain are activated, but also how quickly signals travel through them. In a study published in PLOS-1 in 2008, Kringelbach's team found that when they showed images of babies to adults, there was initial brain activity in the visual cortex and areas responsible for facial recognition, something the team expected. What they also found, however, was rapid activity in the orbitofrontal cortex, an emotional part of the brain, says Kringelbach, and an area also linked to reward-motivated behavior. Images of unfamiliar infant faces activated this area of the brains of women and men, parents and non-parents, in a mere 1/7 of a second, a near-instant response that's atypical. Normally, Kringelbach says, before we respond to something emotionally, you have to identify what is out there, identify what it is, where it is, and then form a judgment. If I am looking at a flower, for example, my brain uses that two-step process. Over the last decade, Kringelbach and colleagues have continued to use MEG to log brain activity in response to the cute and not so cute. They found that the fast pathway response to cuteness can light up not just with the baby's face, but also their smell and the sound of their laughter. This quick response did not occur, however, when study participants viewed adult faces or listened to adult voices. And when individuals looked at images of babies with a congenital deformity known as cleft lip, which disrupts Kinchen schema, says Kringelbach, there was a much diminished response in the orbitofrontal cortex. Many studies in the 20th century have identified a stronger cuteness response from women. When participants are asked to rate how cute babies are, men typically rate the infants lower than women do. However, brain scans tell a different story. Brains can't lie. Their brains show the same response, says Kringelbach. Differences do emerge if cultural expectations about gender-based division of labor leave women providing all of the parental care, he says. But if men are involved in caring for the babies, their brains have the same response as women's. This ultra-fast, gender-neutral response to cuteness activates more than our reward centers. In a 2013 study, researchers recorded the brain activity of participants exposed to both positive and negative infant vocalizations, recordings of giggly, happy babble, and a distress cry. The volunteers also listened to recordings of distress cries from adult humans, dogs, and cats. Brain activity picked up in response to the infant vocalizations markedly faster than all the other stimuli, sometimes in as little as 50 milliseconds. That's 1/20th of a second. The infant crying elicited this very early response, says Kringelbach, a co-author. We are wired for babies. What's intriguing about the rapid response time is the part of the brain that activated, the periaqueductal gray, an area associated not with reward, but with survival behavior and responding to threats. Your brain is put into be ready for something mode, Kringelbach says. When there's a baby around, even if it's not crying, you are ready for something to happen. Other research has shown that both visual and auditory aspects of Kinchen schema prime parents and non-parents alike to be on their A-game. A 2012 study in PLOS-1 found that participants performed both motor dexterity and visual search tasks more accurately after viewing cute images versus non-cute images. In a separate study, Kringelbach's team had participants listen to either a baby crying, an adult crying, or a bird song for 5 minutes. Afterwards, the volunteers played a game similar to the carnival classic whack-a-mole. The group that listened to the baby crying was much faster and more accurate, says Kringelbach. You can't help but react. While few people would call the distress cry of an infant cute, our hardwired, rapid reaction to it appears to be part of the cuteness response. Yet Kringelbach and others who study that response say it's much more than the mechanical reaction Lawrence hypothesized. The greatest power of cuteness may occur after the quick response. In a 2016 Trends in Cognitive Sciences essay, Kringelbach and his colleagues wrote, "Like a Trojan horse, cuteness opens doors that otherwise might remain shut. Cuteness attracts, focuses, and sustains our attention, creating a space in which we can interact positively with the cute object, whether it's an infant, a puppy, or a totes-absorbed baby goat in pajamas on YouTube." Increasingly, researchers see that cuteness response is less about parental nurturing and more about intense social behavior. Our generalized response to Kinchen schema, says Kringelbach, means that babies are always in the in-group. That's why they're great marketing. Everybody wants to be with that baby. And cuteness sells. Mickey Mouse famously underwent a radical cutification in the decades after his 1928 debut. As the Disney empire expanded, Mickey morphed from a scrawny, sharp-featured rodent into a chubby embodiment of Kinchen schema. Other pop culture mainstays exhibit elements of Kinchen schema, from Japanese anime to, well, have you seen the number of cute animal memes and videos online? The ubiquity of cuteness on the internet may be linked to its use as a coping strategy to provide comfort and a sense of community, even if we don't consciously seek it. Cuteness has a really powerful influence on us, and we are often unaware of it, says social psychologist Camilla Knutsen-Steins, who studies cuteness at Consumption Research Norway, part of Oslo Metropolitan University. And like anything with the power to influence, cuteness can have a dark side. Cuteness is something you don't think about because it's so everyday and innocuous, Steins says. You don't look at a baby and think, oh, that's dangerous. I use the term evil cute to describe cuteness used for nefarious purposes, cultural theorist Dale says. Unfortunately, there are many examples, such as gaming companies that make slot machines with cute motifs like kittens to encourage solitary gamblers to play longer and spend more. In 2016, the terrorist organization ISIS, known for gruesome videos of torture and execution, unleashed a propaganda and recruitment campaign featuring armed fighters cuddling kittens. The images had nothing to do with eliciting a caregiving response. Instead, they were likely intended to tap into what a growing number of studies see as the true power of cuteness, its ability to make us feel intense empathy. Or as Stein and Pierce explain it, cuteness evokes kama mutta. The researchers use the Sanskrit word, which they translate as a sudden intensification of communal sharing, because they say that most Western languages lack a term that captures kama mutta in full. You may not have heard the word before, but you have probably experienced kama mutta. Family reunions at airports, heartfelt speeches at weddings, even on-screen moments when beloved, long-parted fictional characters find each other again are common kama mutta triggers. Steins and her colleagues found that viewing and interacting with cute stimuli also evoked kama mutta. The study, published in March in Frontiers in Psychology, had participants report how they felt after viewing cute videos. While the project did not involve brain scans, though they may be part of the team's future research, Stein suspects that the same brain systems activated when we see something cute also activates when we feel kama mutta. Some of the videos shown in the study were less than 30 seconds long, but Stein says some participants reported being so moved that they had tears in their eyes. You can call it love, but it's not how much you love someone. It's the sudden intensification, says UCLA psychological anthropologist Alan Page Fisk, a co-author on the paper who co-leads the kama mutta lab. Stein says the emotion encourages pro-social behavior, including helping others and sharing resources, even with individuals not considered part of your in-group. Because cuteness elicits kama mutta, she adds, it makes you more empathetic. The intensity of kama mutta, Stein says, entices you to experience it again and again, so you seek out that stimuli. The ISIS fighters weren't photographed cuddling kittens to seem cute. They were hitchhiking on the power of cuteness response to make their audience more likely to empathize with them and even perceive them as part of their own group. It's the dark side of both cuteness and the kama mutta that it elicits. Which brings us back to, yes, Nazis. Cuteness and kama mutta promote a bond between the person experiencing the response and the individual or object eliciting it. While cuteness springs from Kinshin schema, it's evoking the same kama mutta as other, less innocuous triggers that lead people to feel an intense common purpose. History is rife with examples of how this can go horribly wrong. Case in point, after Germany's defeat in World War I and its subsequent economic collapse, an aspiring young politician tapped into the shared resentment and despair of his countrymen. In a series of impassioned beer hall speeches, Adolf Hitler fomented this bitterness into a potent, unified resolve to restore Germany to greatness. Once bonded, the question becomes, what do they do with their solidarity, says Fisk. Hitler probably evoked kama mutta in the beer garden, but thank God, so did Churchill and Roosevelt. As scientists learn more about what cuteness does to the brain and the kama mutta it elicits, some experts in the field believe it might be a way to reduce divisiveness in our increasingly fractured world. What Kringelbach once called the Trojan horse of cuteness could be used for good, reducing discrimination against outgroups. Both Steins and Kringelbach cited recent media coverage of refugees, asylum seekers, and other people in distress. When images of the groups include infants and young children, public perception is more positive and the viewer's desire to help is increased. Says Steins, cuteness humanizes. Kringelbach is also working on a project with photographer Tim Flach, whose books include 2017's Haunting Endangered, featuring images of animal species nearing extinction. Together, they hope to explore how cuteness can be used to help endangered species. It's another way Kinshin schema may improve the way we see each other and our environment, with greater empathy and a sense of commonality. Says Kringelbach, I like to think it really could change the world. Heavy metal. Thanks to one man who didn't give up, we know that even small doses of lead can permanently harm growing kids. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan caused untold damage, and poor neighborhoods in cities like New York and Baltimore continue to grapple with the severe health consequences of too much lead in their drinking water. It's a legitimate public health crisis with no clear solutions. But we knew to be concerned in the first place thanks to Herbert Needleman, a pediatrician and child psychiatrist who ended up saving thousands of children from the devastation of lead poisoning. As chief resident at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia in the mid-1950s, Needleman saw a young patient who ultimately led him to his groundbreaking research, which proved that inhaling or ingesting even faint traces of the toxic metal could do irreparable harm. It all began when a desperate mother brought her ill toddler, barely breathing, to the emergency room. The lethargic 3-year-old girl was quickly seen by Needleman. Then a strapping 29-year-old built like a football linebacker with thick glasses. He towered over his tiny patient. Blood tests revealed that the child's lead levels were well above 60 micrograms per deciliter, which qualified as poisoning. Back in the 1950s, lead was everywhere, in paint, water pipes, food containers, toys, and even the air, thanks to its use as an additive in gasoline. But the problem was especially bad in older homes, full of chipped-off layers of lead-based paints. Because the toxic metal tasted sweet, it often proved irresistible to young children. Needleman had no idea this particular case would focus his future on the issue of lead poisoning in children. He simply proceeded with the customary treatment of chelation therapy, medicine that binds with lead and exits the body with urine, which cleansed the child's body of the toxic metal and brought her back to life. "It was a gratifying experience, and I felt very smug," Needleman later recalled in an interview for Public Health Reports. "I told the mother that she had to move out of that house. If her daughter had another episode, she would be permanently affected." "Where am I supposed to move?" the mother responded. "All the houses I can afford are the same age." It stunned Needleman, who worked in one of Philadelphia's poorest neighborhoods. That's when he realized lead poisoning wasn't just a health issue, but a byproduct of poverty, too. This insight would shape the rest of his career and change society's relationships with lead. In those days, scientists knew high doses of lead could cause permanent brain damage, even death. But they also thought the body could withstand a fair amount of exposure and children could recover from poisoning without lasting damage. Needleman had a particular skill set as a psychiatrist and a pediatrician that allowed him to see that lead poisoning was much more prevalent than the medical establishment realized. He was able to see the enormity of the problem when so many other people were dead set on saying it wasn't one, says Lydia Denworth, author of Toxic Truth, A Scientist, A Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead. Industry scientists were seen as experts, and they swore up and down that there was no problem, that there wasn't any sense they might not be able to be independent arbiters. But how could Needleman prove Philadelphia was in the middle of an undetected epidemic? Blood tests wouldn't suffice because they only measured immediate exposures, not chronic ones. Fingernails and hair were too dirty to be an accurate measure. A bone biopsy would reveal how much lead the body was storing. Lead chemically mimics calcium, but the process would be arduous, costly, and unethical. Then, while gazing out of his office windows at kids on a school playground, Needleman had an epiphany that would change scientific history. Children have another depository of calcium much more accessible than bones, their baby teeth. Needleman began gathering teeth from thousands of young children in poor communities, as well as in rich neighborhoods to provide a basis for comparison. He became a real-life tooth fairy, offering the children, who were 6 or 7 years old, gifts in exchange for their baby teeth that had fallen out. The results would show how much lead had accumulated in their bodies. "The idea of collecting teeth was brilliant," says Irving Shapiro, a specialist in the biochemistry of teeth, who was on the dental school faculty at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, and who would become Needleman's collaborator. "It was a huge advance because now we had real cumulative measures of lead exposure over critical periods in a child's life." The initial findings, published in 1972 in Nature, revealed that children in impoverished urban areas had more than 5 times the amount of lead in their bodies than their suburban counterparts, and at least 20% of the urban kids had blood lead levels higher than 63 micrograms per deciliter. The findings also showed testing teeth was a legitimate way to evaluate cumulative lead levels, providing a platform for further research. Around this time, Needleman heard from Philip Landergan, a young pediatrician. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had sent him to investigate lead poisoning in children living near a smelter in El Paso, Texas, that had belched out over 1,000 tons of lead in the previous 3 years. An initial field study of about 40 kids revealed widespread lead poisoning. Needleman's conviction, still untested, that minuscule levels of lead caused profound damage to health and cognition, motivated Landrigan to do a follow-up study in 1973 to test his hypothesis. The results were alarming. Kids with higher lead levels, more than 40 micrograms per deciliter, which is 8 times what is now considered safe, had significantly slower motor skills and an average reduction in intelligence of about 7 IQ points. This was all despite the lead industry's assurances that anything up to 80 micrograms per deciliter was harmless. Even if lead levels were too low to produce obvious symptoms in children, says Landrigan, now the director of Boston College's Global Public Health Program, real damage was still being done. Meanwhile, Needleman had embarked on what became a landmark study that compared the levels of lead with each child's school performance and IQ. The results, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1979, were astonishing. In examining more than 2,000 children, the investigators found even small levels of lead, as little as 20 micrograms, had a dramatic impact on intellectual development and behavior. Kids who had the highest exposure to lead scored 4 points lower on IQ tests than their peers with the lowest exposure and had serious difficulties in school. The discovery transformed thinking about the effects of lead on children's health, and society started changing its relationship with the metal. The research began to fuel support for anti-lead environmental movements, as seen in the 1970s with the EPA's ban on lead-based house paint and government mandates to start phasing lead additives out of gasoline. But that didn't stop the lead industry from publishing its own contrary studies and criticizing Needleman's research methodology. By the 1990s, the attacks came to his doorstep at the University of Pittsburgh. Psychologist Claire Earnhardt noticed some arithmetic errors in Needleman's research and accused him of fraud. His university locked him out of the lab. He wasn't allowed on campus, and he spent 3 years in an agonizing limbo before he was exonerated. He made some mistakes, says Denworth, but not enough to disqualify the work, and his results held up. Needleman continued to push for more stringent safety regulations. His research is credited with lowering average blood lead levels in American children by 78% between 1976 and 1991, and saving thousands of youngsters from a lifetime of disability. Needleman went on to do other important work, including other groundbreaking studies that measured lead levels in young men in prison. It turns out that they had higher lead levels than their free peers, a finding that linked lead poisoning to criminality and to the epidemic of violence in poor urban areas. In his final years, Needleman was hailed as a public health hero, and he received numerous awards, including the prestigious Heinz Award in the environment. He was a tough guy who grew up in the streets of Philadelphia, says Landrigan, of his old friend, who died in 2017 at the age of 89. Not everyone would have stood up to the attacks from the lead industry, he says. Part of his legacy was his heroism. Still, the legacy of lead isn't completely over. Just ask the residents of Flint. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.